Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 19th, 2000. In the fireside room this morning is Larry Rasmussen. Today's session number is 2008, and it's titled Deep Christian Traditions as Earth Faiths, Sacramentalism, the Hymn of the Universe. Let's listen in.
This is the third session in a series this week on deep Christian traditions as foundations for an earth-honoring faith, Christianity, a version, a kinds of expressions of Christianity that do justice to all creation. And the topic for today, as you can see from the board, is sacramental communion, the traditions of sacramentalism, probably most associated with Roman Catholic, Orthodox, Anglican traditions, but Lutherans also have a sacramentalist orientation and expression, one that I don't think we've done well with in terms of expressing the moral and ethical implications of it for earth keeping. But sacramental communion as ritually enacting in community the hymn of the universe itself. Now that phrase, the hymn of the universe, is from Teilhard de Chardin, and there is a book by Teilhard called The Hymn of the Universe. Unfortunately, we don't have it in the library, even though the library has a nice collection of Teilhard's works. The Hymn of the Universe is not there. It's a sacramental, mystical description, if you will, it's not a good word, for his experience of the universe. Teilhard was a Jesuit priest who was a paleontologist, actually a very significant figure in the history of science. So if you do come across Teilhard de Chardin, The Hymn of the Universe, pick it up, read it. The question for today will be, have you had an experience of sacramental communion that is earth-honoring and earth-inclusive? What I'm going to do is, after reading the dedication in Thomas Berry's The Great Work to you, and just a very short excerpt from Annie Dillard on the Cascades as examples of sacramental communion and that kind of orientation. It's a whole orientation toward life. Then I want to give you the gist of that tradition as best I can, and then go to a few examples from just excerpts from different figures, and we'll see what the time is. I want to get to the question. We may or may not take time to look at some photos of communities where this tradition is drawn upon, the Marino Ecological Sanctuary in the Philippines, the African Association of Earthkeeping Churches, IONA. Thomas Berry, the dedication in the book that I'm pushing these days, it's available in the bookstore, The Great Work, Our Way into the Future. Tom Berry himself comes out of this tradition of sacramentalism, is a cultural historian and a passionist priest. To the children, to all the children, to the children who swim beneath the waves of the sea, to those who live in the soils of the earth, to the children of the flowers, in the meadows, in the trees, in the forest, to all those children who roam over the land, and the winged ones who fly with the winds, to the human children, too, that all the children may go together into the future in the full diversity of their communities. To all of the children who belong together in their communities. It's an expression of a kind of life orientation of sacramental communion to all the children. The Annie Dillard, Holy and Firm. This is in the bookstore. The Cascade Range in these high latitudes backs almost into the water. There is only a narrow strip, an afterthought of foothills and farms, 60 miles wide, between the snowy mountains and the sea. The mountains wall well. The rest of the country, most of the rest of the planet in some very real sense, excluding a shred of British Columbia's coastline in the Alaskan Islands, is called and profoundly felt to be simply east of the mountains. I've been there. I came here to study hard things, rock, mountain, and salt sea, and to temper my spirit on their edges. Teach me thy ways, O Lord, is like all prayers a rash one, and one I cannot but recommend. These mountains, Mount Baker and the Sisters and the Shuksan, okay? The Canadian coastal range and the Olympics on the peninsula are surely the edge of the known and comprehended world. They are high. That they bear their own unimaginable masses and weathers aloft, holding them in the sky for anyone to see plain, makes them, as Chesterton said of the Eucharist, only the more mysterious by their visibility and absence of secrecy. They are the western rim of the real, if not considerably beyond it. If the Greeks had looked at Mount Baker all day, their large and honest art would have broken. These are the great Greek sculptures of human beings. This is what they always sculpted, not the mountains or the sea. The Greeks had looked at Mount Baker all day, their large and honest art would have broken, and they would have gone fishing, as these people do. And so perhaps I one day shall. Only a passing reference to the Eucharist there, but one in which she is drawn immediately to make the comparison somehow of this being filled by the presence of the landscape and connecting it with a sacrament who is just or in a like way mysterious, at the same time utterly visible. Okay, then what is this tradition of sacramentalism or sacramental communion? It's an ancient and a living tradition. We have great liturgies in this tradition from the earliest churches around the rim of the Mediterranean basins. Many of them are just filled with nature. One of them I ran into was in Alaska, in the Orthodox Church in Alaska, where in January the Native Alaskans go and cut a cross-shaped hole in the ice. And they then dip waters, which is life. The sea is life for them. They dip some of the waters and take out some of the waters of life, and then they go around to their homes and they bless their homes with this kind of baptism of the waters of life. But the liturgy is the sanctification of the waters, and it's an ancient Russian Orthodox liturgy that just fit with Alaskan experience of the waters of the sea as the waters of life, and that then they are purified in the waters, the house is blessed in the waters, and the waters themselves are sanctified. And it's an ancient Orthodox liturgy on the sanctification of the waters. Well, many of these early liturgies from the rim of the Mediterranean, 2nd, 3rd, 4th century, are these liturgies of a people of the land. At the Canberra Assembly of the World Council of Churches, in the plenary session on the ecumenical decade of the churches in solidarity with women around the world, women from different countries, South America, South Africa, the Philippines, United States, Canada, Palestine, each in turn went to the microphone and told her story of the particular struggles that she was engaged with as the rest of her community in her home country. And at the end of the her tale, she took a green branch and she placed it on a wooden structure that was lying flat on the stage. And in turn, this wooden structure greened. And at the end of the session, all of the women together went over and they lifted this wooden structure, now green, and it was the tree, the cross, become the tree of life. And then to an Armenian Orthodox bishop who had been very supportive of the program of the Churches in Solidarity with Women in his diocese, came up and simply explained that the greening of the cross was an ancient Armenian Orthodox liturgy. So a number of these liturgies of the ancient world are expressions of sacramental communion. They revolve around the sacraments in one way or another, which are creation-filled understanding of communion, of community. So just an effort to kind of encapsulate this tradition, even though I'm well aware that it has to be lived into. I can't kind of conceptually convey its reality. It's a matter of all of the senses together, and it's not an idea, though I of necessity must present it that way. In the sacramentalist tradition, life in its totality is brought into the worshipful presence of God. And there, life in its totality is to be renewed in contemplative and sacramental practices. The real message here is that life is a gift of God, and all life is a medium of grace. It's more in this tradition, in many of its expressions, not all of them, but in many of its expressions, it's more than a gathering of God and humankind. Sacramental communion is ritually enacting the hymn of the universe itself. Its great acts are the acts of the cosmic drama of creation and its redemption. Its great acts are the cosmic drama of the cosmic story, and it's one in which God is proclaimed as both beyond any dimensions that we can know. So there's always an atmosphere of mystery and the transcendence of God and the kind of our incapacity to know the full dimensions of God's presence in the cosmos. At the same time, God is as near as the grain and the grape. God is as near as the splashing water and the shared cup. God is as near as the oil on the forehead. It tries to combine that mysterious transcendence of the ineffable one, whose name we cannot even know, with the immediate presence of that God in what we can touch and see and smell. And its creation and its transfiguration, to use the Orthodox language, together with human salvation, that's a great theme here. And in the Orthodox tradition, Eastern Christian traditions, now they're global, but having their origins there, in the Orthodox tradition, it is, in the Eucharist, it's the transfiguration of all nature. It's all of nature that is being held up in praise to its creator, and the priest is the mediator who also conveys to all creation the knowledge of who its creator is. It's not just simply human beings who are transfigured or transformed. It is all nature. I was at a loss in trying to figure out how to do sacramental communion in one session today, and I was at a loss because I didn't know whether I should do a history of recent centuries and what is sometimes called the Western disenchantment of the world, or the denaturization of the world in the last centuries in the West. That is a kind of rage against finitude and a kind of understanding that freedom is always overcoming previous limits that are imposed upon us by nature, together with this disenchantment of the world. I mean, Zarco's powerful presentation in Vespers last night was in part a plaintive cry about the loss of the diffused sense of the sacred in the cultures of indigenous peoples of the land with the coming of the West. That loss of the diffused sacrality and spirit in nature is the disenchantment of the world that sociologists have been telling us about since Max Weber. And this loss of the mystery and the sacred in the everyday and the ordinary, and a growing commodification of everything. The triumph of a utilitarian spirit, where as Mike has said in his sessions, we treat everything as resources, and now we're even talking about social capital and human capital.
Human resources.
Yeah, and human resources and human capital. It's in keeping with the spirit of the particular kind of economic order we have that, as Karl Marx and others noted, in the mid-1800s, will lead to the commodification of all things. So you'll be drinking bottled water and selling air rights in New York City. Together with a kind of ethos of global management and control. I didn't know whether to do that or not, but it's necessary to say that because the cosmology and the kind of the theology of most of our working institutions and practices is out of that history almost the antithesis of sacramental communion, which attempts to attempts to feel the sacred character of the material world. It's an enchanted world, if you will, as contrasted with a disenchanted world. In the disenchanted world, where the spirit is removed from nature, the numinous, the holy, is beaten from the common, and the sacred is kind of leached out of the ordinary and the everyday. Now, we can't totally lose that. My wife is a labor and delivery nurse. She's been doing it for 30 years. She still calls each of those births intimate and sacred. They don't all turn out well. But there is something of the mysterious and the holy in that. We don't, being who we are, creatures, we don't lose it entirely, but there is so much in our lives that runs against sacramental communion as an encompassing orientation to life, and it is, of course, meant to form people through the participation in the sacramental life of the church into a way of life in which God is in with and under all that is finite, in with and under the oil and the grain and the grape and the splashing waters and the shared cup. And so, in one way or another, this tradition is, to use a technical theological term now, a panentheistic tradition. And I put the word up here, panentheism. Again, it's the Orthodox who have been most insistent about that. Pan, the Greek meaning all, in, theism, God. And then, God present in, with, and under all things finite. And of course, this is also Luther's insistence. Luther is a panentheist. Luther says that the finite bears the infinite. It got entangled in all those Reformation discussions about, is Jesus Christ present in the the bread and the wine, and in what way? But Luther's insistence all the way through was that the finite, the natural, if you will, the material world, carries God, carries the infinite. The transcendent one is immanent. If you want to know where God is, he says to Kate, his good wife, look in your milk pail. Okay, God's in your beans and in your milk. These wonderful images about tickling the belly button of God when Mary was tickling Jesus. Luther's great on these things. We don't read him through that tradition very often of insistence that the finite buries the infinite, and the presence and power of God is in, with, and under all that is. So, having not been able to figure out which I should do, a kind of history of why this is difficult for us to kind of grab hold of. It runs against the grain of our utilitarian way of leaning into the world. And on the one hand, in facing such a wide-ranging and deep and varied history of sacramentalism, on the other hand, what I decided to do was just to read you a few excerpts from a variety of sources. And then go to our question, and then if you want to, we can look at some of the photos. While I'm reading some of these excerpts, I will just send around a publication of the World Council of Churches. It's edited by Edna Orteza from the Philippines. It's called What Do We Mean When We Say Sacred? A resource handbook on culture and identity. And it's mostly about the loss of the sense of sacred around the world and the remembering of that by primarily indigenous peoples. So it's a lot of excerpts of materials of indigenous peoples whose culture and identity had been shaped in such a way as to experience the loss of the cosmos as a sacrament. So I'll just send that around.
Could I ask you a question?
Yes, anytime.
Could you just give, where does the word sacrament come from? What does it mean? It seems related to sacred, but I don't know what it actually means when you say sacrament.
Yeah.
You've been talking about it.
Well, you've got the core there, as you've already intimated. Sacrament's got to have something to do with sacred. And I don't know exactly. Maybe some other people can help out. But in the history of Christian theology, you have varied kind of definitions, if you will, of the sacrament. So Augustine, with a visible sign of the invisible presence of God. That's repeated again by Calvin and others, that emphasis that the sacrament is something tangible, real, something ordinary and everyday.
It involves matter.
But it's a matter to sometimes be a symbol, sometimes be the medium itself of the invisible. Or in the Orthodox tradition, you always have this notion that you've got the visible world and the invisible world, and they're really the same world, or as they say in Iona, Iona is a thin place where the visible world and the invisible world are both present together. The sacraments make the invisible visible in the ordinary and everyday. And but then they have a special place in the sacramental practices of the church. So the bread that we dedicate in the sacrament of the Eucharist is held up as and dedicated as a special bread. It's ordinary bread, and at the same time, it now becomes a vehicle of the invisible, and all of it's sacred.
So there can be sacraments outside the Christian tradition?
That's a good question, and are there folks who know whether other religious traditions talk about sacraments? You certainly have the parallel rituals in which you're doing the same thing, where the visible is a way of communicating, a sign and symbol of the
invisible. My sense is that the term is uniquely Christian.
It may be.
a little bit there, the etiology is that in Greek the word is mysteria, which are the things that have been revealed.
Yeah.
And so that was used both, I mean, Paul talks about the mysteries, but that was also used in certain Greek and Egyptian mystery religions, and that the word sacrament comes into play with the translation by Jerome from a Greek New Testament into the Vulgate. So as Jerome is grappling for what kind of word talks about the mysteries of God and the mysteries in the church, he uses the term sacramental, which means simply holy things.
And we get it from the Latin.
Sacramentum. Sacrament is from the Latin, meaning holy things. And then that opens the wonderful debate within Christianity about what counts as the holy thing.
Yes.
Yeah. And for example, Augustine has over 50 sacraments, holy things. I mean, of course, it's baptism and the Lord's Supper, but also festival days would count, and saints' days were considered to be holy things. So Trinity Sunday or Pentecost, Easter would be a holy day, and other things would be holy things. And you know, and what's happened in the tradition is we keep narrowing it down until we get to the kind of classic seven sacraments within medieval Catholicism, and Lutherans narrow that a little more, and others. But it's simply the notion of holy things.
Huh. Thanks, Michael. I didn't know that about Jerome and kind of the etiology of that. There's a nice comment by Robert Jensen, a Lutheran theologian, in one of his books, which now connects with that in a way I didn't really catch before. And he's saying that in Lutheran theology, anything can be a sacrament. And in light of this sort of identification with holy things, that's, I mean, he's not proposing a longer list. It's not shorter and longer lists, but the gist of it there. Yeah. Thanks. Yes, Dorothy.
I've heard some contemporary Catholic theologians refer in a way that I find helpful to sacraments and sacramentals.
Oh.
So that if, and I think there's a very sacramental view of life in general or in Catholic theology, but that say if baptism is a sacrament, the remembrance of that in a baby's bathtub, or the being out in the shower,
Sacramental.
Sacramentals.
Oh, that's nice too.
Or so that the sacrament of the table.
Yeah.
the sacramentals that we experience daily at our other tables.
Yeah. That's nice. And that helps me too. Now, what I'm really talking about here is sacramental. A sacramental orientation toward all of life, and that is earth-honoring and earth-inclusive. Yeah. So that we start making the connections between the waters of baptism as a sacrament and all the waters that we see flowing. May they be safe and safe waters and waters of life as sacramental. Okay, just a few excerpts here. This is from a community that I visited in St. Louis, the Sisters of Loreto Earth Network, and one of the members has written a doctoral dissertation. I know you didn't come to listen to a doctoral dissertation. About the changing Roman Catholic sacramentalism of this particular community of women, religious, and one which is now deeply influenced by Thomas Berry and the new science, which tells the whole story, like the community in the Philippines, which tells the whole story of evolution from the Big Bang to the present as the story of the flaming forth of the universe from the heart of God. The primordial revelation of God is the universe itself. And the religious story is the evolution of the cosmos, of which we are the part that prays, which we are the part to speak.
P-R-E-Y.
No, well, no. I was thinking P-R-A-Y, but in this story of the cosmos, it's common to locate the distinctiveness of the human species as that one which is self-reflective and able to give voice in praise and prayer. To what has been. And this is actually in keeping with the Orthodox notion that all human beings are priests, because they have the human vocation is to voice the praise of creation to the Creator and to mediate the knowledge of the Creator to all of creation. It's a priestly task. Okay. Beth Blissman, who wrote this, is just quoting one of the sisters, and she says she's just citing her because of the testimony of this sister, the kind of yearning of this sister. I want to keep learning about how radically and lovingly we humans are bonded with all the rest of creation, and how radically and lovingly our God has been and is involved in every earthly process. I want to be grateful with every breath I draw for the co-inheritance that connects me with the trees, the animals, the sun, and the rain into a living whole through and with and in our God. I want to see in the sacraments a relationship not just to the historical Christ, but also to the cosmic Christ, in whom everything was and is and will be created. It's the first opening of John's Gospel. I want to appreciate baptism in such a way that I am led to deepen my reverence for the mysterious and wonderful gift of water in our homes, the rivers, the oceans, the rain. And I want to celebrate Eucharist with bread and wine that reminds me of Jesus' Last Supper and also connects me with the great universal law of all creation, that everything that is always is always eater or eaten, to sense myself in communion with the earth's ongoing cycle. I am seeing anew, or perhaps for the first time, the dramatic implications of incarnation. And that's one who was brought up in this tradition, who now expresses her desire to deepen it. Let's see. Just maybe two more examples. One from what may be an unlikely source if you know the whole Calvinist tradition, which was iconoclastic and wanted to get rid of all images, which insisted that it was Scripture that was the revelation of God, and you ought not to trust nature as the revelation of God. That was a debate. And so Belden Lane, who did this wonderful book on desert and mountain spirituality, it's a book called The Solace of Fierce Landscapes, in which he shows that the spirituality mirrors the landscape itself. He's now working as a Presbyterian historian and a historian of American religious thought, working on nature and the Reformed tradition, which is not where you'd expect sacramental communion to be if you know something of the history. But for John Calvin, nature was the theater of the glory of God, and it's a later Protestants that basically lose this as a part of this disenchantment of the world. All creatures, Calvin says, are able to act as witnesses of God's glory. The beasts clamor for God, the elements dread God, the mountains echo God, the grass and the flowers laugh before God. It's kind of nice. But then Karl Barth, who never spent a whole lot of time here, has some lovely passages in the Church Dogmatics. I know you didn't expect to hear from volume 3.3. When Barth writes Church Dogmatics, it isn't just volume 3 and volume 4. It's 3.1, 3.2, 3.3, 3.4, and then 4.1, 4.2, 4.3, etc. Well, this is Church Dogmatics 3.3. It's a section called The Divine Preserving. And this, too, this you'll hear a new dimension that I haven't talked about the tradition of sacramental communion. It's a way of talking about how all things are kept in God. We experience their transiency, but they are preserved in the one who enfolds the universe. And one day, to speak in temporal terms, when the totality of everything that was and is and will be only will have been, then in the totality of its temporal duration, it will still be open and present to God. Remember, this is a Swiss-German writing, so this is two sentences. So I'm going to have to take a breath now and then. And I haven't come to a semicolon yet. Okay, and therefore preserved, colon. Eternally preserved, semicolon. Revealed in all its greatness and littleness, judged according to its rightness and wrongness, its value or lack of value, but revealed in its participation in the love which God has directed toward it. Therefore, nothing will escape God. No aspect of the great game of creation, I like this, no moment of human life, no thinking thought, no word spoken will be lost. No secret or insignificant enterprise or deed or omission with all of its interaction and effects. No suffering or joy. No sincerity or lie. No secret event in heaven or too well-known event on earth. No ray of sunlight. No note which ever sounded will be lost. No color which has ever been revealed, possibly in the darkness of the oceanic depths where the human has never perceived it, no wing beat of the day fly in far-flung epochs of geological time. Period. That's the end of the first sentence. Not even the wing beat of the day fly in far-flung epochs of geological time will be lost. Everything will be present to God exactly as it was or is or will be in all its reality, in the whole temporal course, in its activity, in its strength or weakness, in its majesty or meanness. God will not allow anything to perish, but will hold it in the hollow of God's hand, as God has always does, has done, does, and will do. God will not be alone in eternity, but with the creature. God will allow it to partake of God's own eternal life. And in this way, the creature will continue to be in its limitation, even in its limited temporal duration, in all the unrest of its being and time, it will be enfolded by the rest of God. For God's mercy endures forever. Psalm 136. End of sentence two. It's a moving passage of the notion that everything is enfolded in this great sacrament of creation and the holy things. And I've spoken of the Orthodox tradition, and maybe I think I should just read from St. Isaac the Syrian. Syrian Christianity has been largely lost to us, but Arab Christianity was a powerful and formative force. Maximus the Confessor, St. Isaac the Syrian. There are a lot of great theologians of the sacramentalist tradition among Christian Arabs. And Antioch, you know, is the first place where Christians get called Christians. They call themselves the people of the way, but they start to be called Christians as the followers of Jesus the Christ in Antioch, and that's Syria. So one of those early theologians, St. Isaac the Syrian, and I don't have Isaac's dates here, but maybe does anybody know? I think it's about 3rd or 4th century, it says. Talking about the effects of being nurtured in the sacramental tradition as one of learning compassion with one's whole body. And so St. Isaac the Syrian asks, "What is a compassionate heart? It is a heart which burns for the whole of creation, for the birds, for the beasts of the earth, for every creature. So strong, so violent is this compassion that his heart breaks when it sees the misfortune and suffering of the least creature. This is why it prays even for the snakes. In the immense, immeasurable compassion that arises in the heart, which is in the image of God." Finally, just a couple of things from medieval Catholicism, which is again another of the times in which this widespread tradition gets expressed. I'll spend some time tomorrow, or the day after tomorrow, actually, on mysticism, which is closely allied, at least if you're Roman Catholic, with the two. So I'm going to take up Hildegard of Bingen and the women medieval mystics then. But Bonaventure, and I'm actually citing from Elizabeth Johnson's wonderful address, The Cosmos, An Astonishing Image of God. And she, in this one section, talks about Bonaventure and Aquinas. Bonaventure instructs the soul journeying toward God to see the universe as a wonderful work of art in which one recognizes traces of its maker. And now she's quoting Bonaventure. Bonaventure and Hildegard would have been contemporaries, so. Whoever is not enlightened by the splendor of created things is blind. Whoever is not aroused by the sound of their voice is deaf. Whoever does not praise God for all these creatures is mute. Whoever, after so much evidence, does not recognize the first principle, God, is an idiot. There you have it. You can check yourself on that list. Okay, then one of a passage from Aquinas, and I love Aquinas, even though never mind. God brought things into being in order that the divine goodness might be communicated to creatures and be represented by them. And because the divine goodness could not be adequately represented by one creature alone, read one species, God produced many and diverse creatures, that what was wanting in one, in the representation of divine goodness, might be supplied by another. For goodness, which in God is simple and uniform, in creatures is manifold and divided. Thus, the whole universe together participates in divine goodness more perfectly and represents it better than any single creature whatsoever. And Aquinas goes on to say, you've really got to have biodiversity. That's not his term. You understand that. You've really got to have biodiversity in order to have God imaged in creation. And all of it together is the perfection. No one creature can be the image
or the
expression of the glory of God. And until they all do it in harmony, God will not be wholly known. It's quite a remarkable passage there. And a representative of Earth, of an enchanted universe, a glory-filled universe, a universe in which God is present and powerful in, with, and under all that is, and all that is required in order to reflect the presence and power of God. It's another whole session, but how we got to the point where we became an ecologically segregated species and then saw that as the one place where God was, the image of God was present in the world, namely in us, is a tale, an important tale in itself, even though it's in some ways a rather recent one. I've never really quite understood why we think it's a great consolation to be alone in the universe. To think that being the one image in the one species or creature in the image of God is something that one would desire. So that if we're all by ourselves, as a unique species in the world, that this is something great, that to emphasize that we aren't kin as somehow something we ought to relish is strange. Okay, the very last thing I want to say about this tradition and its change, and then go to the question, is that the communities that I visited that have drawn on this tradition, especially the Marinal Ecological Sanctuary in the Philippines, are in great revolt, the Sisters of Loreto as well, are in great revolt against the way that tradition that they draw upon is portrayed. Now, why? Because the cosmology of medieval Catholicism, the way in which the universe reality is ordered or structured, is one which has been tremendously influential in Christian history, and not just Catholicism, and Protestantism as well. It's called the cosmology of the great chain of being, in which God is at the top and is pure spirit. And then you've got a ranking or an ordering of creation down to the very bottom, which is unorganic matter. And just below God are the angels and the heavenly creatures. And just below that in this ranking, this laddering of creation, are human beings. And then below human beings are, I suppose, great apes. And then on down the line.
And within humankind, there's an ordering.
And then within humankind, there's an ordering. And again, Zarco's powerful plaintiff, oration prayer in Vespers last night is an example of the ordering within. It's gendered, first of all, so males are over females. Now, why is that? Because females are closer to nature, and men are more in keeping with the rational soul, and God is the ultimate spirit and rational soul. So everything that's closer to nature is farther down the ladder. Everything that's closer to spirit is closer to God. And it was understood, it was taught, I suppose by the men, that they occupy this place. And peoples who are not and so advanced in science and technology and rationality were regarded as more primitive and closer to nature. Women were closer to nature. Indigenous peoples who were then met in the contact with the sliding out of globalization from Europe in the first wave were regarded as closer to nature. And of course, civilization had to be brought to the more primitive, and that which was closer to nature, slaves in the law, were regarded as not fully human. They also were closer to nature. So this cosmic chain of being was the way in which sacramental communion itself was expressed. So in medieval Catholicism, the whole universe is alive with the presence of God, but it's ordered in this way. And now we have both a new cosmology and we have a new science. And the new science has moved from a Newtonian view, which is a very mechanistic. That comes between medieval Catholicism and is a part of modernity, where the world is very mechanistic. Descartes sees the human subject as the only source of sure knowledge, and the rest is object to it. So it's a subject-object relationship of human being to the rest of the world as essentially plastic. And now there's the new science, which has succeeded that mechanistic view of the universe, and it's a relational, dynamic one, in which you have a kind of ecological relationship, life, the web of life, and the story of evolution as an open, dynamic, chancy thing. It's beautifully reflected in Annie Dillard's work and Thomas Berry's. So there's an embrace of the new science and a different ordering of creation in the traditions of sacramental communion is what I'm trying to say. So one has to do the assessment or critique of the expression of it. Okay, that's plenty for me. Have you had an experience of sacramental communion that is earth-honoring and earth-inclusive? It's testimony time. It's witness. Time to witness.
I don't know if I realized it at the moment, but as a child I was very curious, and in the church that I grew up in, you didn't receive communion until you were in fourth or fifth grade after you went through the classes and for first communion. And my mom could find me at home sometimes when I was 7 or 8 giving soda crackers and grape juice to my sister and brother, because I was curious about this thing, and it was play. It was just as you play doctor or you play house, it was playing whatever that thing was at church that we didn't know about.
Yeah.
And I've tried to make sense of the sacraments now as a 25-year-old, and what is this in my life and why is it important to me? I go back to another childhood experience, which I think Annie Dillard talks about in another book, Pilgrim Tinker Creek, of seeing for the first time. And I think that that's what the sacraments are often, again and again, is seeing for the first time. And as a child growing up in northern Minnesota, my dad would bring me outside at 2 a.m. sometimes to see the northern lights. And I never knew when this was going to occur. I never knew why it was on this night versus the other night. And this experience of going out of my dad's shoulders and seeing these northern lights is my definition of grace, of being invited into something. And I guess seeing those questions, I go, wow, that's what it was. It was that sacrament of being invited into a space and going, yes, this is the face of God. And now I see communion and the sacraments are very important to me. When I, you know, go through the line, and the person that gives the bread or the person that gives the wine, that seeing their eyes and for that moment, that's the face of God, you know, looking, and we can't avoid it. And I think in those moments, those aha moments when we can't avoid the face, whatever it is, I think that's a sacrament.
Yeah, lovely.
There was a, what you would call it, a process that was done here at Holden 2 years ago in September. And it was a time which made me realize the fragility of our earth. And it's a service in which a huge spiral is laid out. And the important points of time of things happening are done with a candle at this time, and a person walks this huge time millennium around and around and around to present day. And for instance, Columbus with, you know, various kinds of things. And to see how huge that spiral is until you get to, you know, the things of known time is absolutely phenomenal. It was a wonderful experience.
This is what's happening now to a lot of people in New York at the new Rose Center at the Planetarium, at the Museum of Natural History in New York, because they have a thanks to...
There's a name for it.
Yeah, well, what is the name for it? But anyway, it starts with the Big Bang,
right.
And you go in there and you listen to Jodie Foster will take you on this trip, which is nice. Which is very nice. It's narrated by Jodie. First, you go into the planetarium and Tom Hanks will take you on a cosmic journey, and that's a tremendous thing. Then you go on the timeline, and then you walk down the ramp, and then you end up. And human time is the width of a hair at the end of a football field. So, yeah, anyway.
When I think of the sacraments, I think of the body and the blood of Christ. And I think of when it all started, when he was at the table, a Passover table, and he said, "It's in remembrance of me." And I think how awesome it is that we can remember a man 200 years ago as if it were just the other day. 2,000 years ago, as if it were just the other day. I mean, that's pretty awesome in itself that has not been forgotten.
Yeah.
That it can carry on till the day he comes again, I believe. You know, I mean, that sacrament is a pretty strong, powerful thing.
Yeah. And that you could have the impact of that, you know, two millennia later, to the part of the mystery of the whole. Dale?
I think the hierarchical orientation that we have in our Christian approach has made it difficult for me to identify with the Indian sense of revelation role of the animals. That they seem to turn to the animals for guidance and revelation.
Yeah. We've lost that. It's not lost in Christianity. It's lost in modern Christianity.
Okay.
When I went to the Coptic monastery in the desert of Egypt, one of the stories they'd like to tell out of these tales of the desert fathers and mothers is of old Macarius. Now, Macarius was a disciple of Anthony, who was the founder of one form of monasticism, hermit or anchorite, monasticism. And the stories always include Macarius being ministered to by the animals. And if you read the lives of the saints, you always get a presentation of saints and animals living together harmoniously, and often the animals being the ministering to the saints in their times of doubt and despair or dread. So it's not something that isn't present in Christian traditions, but it's been lost to us. And sometimes it's the peoples of the earth, indigenous peoples, who need to teach us that all over again.
Yeah,
One other direction to go. For me, the marital sexual oneness is a revelation of oneness that is for me sacramental.
And one, of course, one of the, maybe it's the, other than the giftedness of life, and all life is a medium of grace, maybe the other strong theme of this tradition is communion, being at one with all that is. We are truly at home here, rather than this business of the consolation of being alone in the universe, aliens on our own planet.
I thought when I read the question, Larry, of a book that really impressed me in the, I think in the mid-70s I discovered it, Monica Helwig's The Eucharist and the Hunger of the World.
Yeah.
And she spends a lot of time on the way the sacrament of the altar is for us a statement of inclusivity, human inclusivity, that everybody is welcome, that all are at the same level. It's a democratic meal. It has political and social implications. But she also spends some time on the earth and the earth as the sustainer of life, of all life. The creation is a sustainer of all life, and how the sacrament of Holy Communion is a statement about that. And far beyond the, I grew up with a highly spiritualized understanding of the sacrament as a Lutheran kid.
What's
in
the
Midwest, and she says, it's not just spiritual, it's also material.
What's the economy
of the
Eucharist?
Now.
What's the economy of the Eucharist? What's the politics of baptism?
That's right.
That book by Monica Helwig.
You know that book.
The Eucharist and the Hungers of the World is a classic.
It's a,
tiny, tiny little thing.
Very small.
I didn't think to check to see if we have it in the bookstore. Helwig, H-E-L-L-W-I-G.
Roman Catholic theologian.
At Georgetown, and I hope we Lutherans do something with the kind of the public expression of baptism and Eucharist, because our social ethics has come out of another whole tradition, the two kingdoms, etc. And we then end up not relating our experience of the sacraments, despite Stacy's experience or testifying to yours, we end up not making the connections between our participation in the sacraments and the rest of the universe, you know.
Or to politics, or
literal
social
hungers,
justice,
literal hungers.
Right.
Yes.
That beautiful idea of Aquinas about the necessity of all of these creatures, all of these species, it's a shame that he didn't sense that in terms of other faith expressions also. But for us then, thinking of the ways in which people praise God, we've had a, I remember Caspar Nervig's book, Lutheran Church, The Church of Truth, and somebody else, mostly truth and a little error, and some truth and lots of error. We've had this picture that we have the presentation of the glory of God, and all this other stuff around there, Native American spirituality, anything related to those pagans could praise God.
No.
And if we would take his thoughts seriously, there, all of these things have something to say, and that's got to be shocking to our theology.
I don't know. I think it comes from two directions. One is, I haven't figured this out, but there is a kind of rage against nature in our psyches, and it's more male than female, but it's present.
Conquering the wilderness.
I don't know. It may be we don't want to embrace our finitude, as Luther says, is the only way to be human. We want to somehow conquer our finitude, or overcome it, or something along that line. And the other thing, as you pointed out, Aquinas is a part of a medieval Europe, and a notion that Christianity is the ultimate expression of truth. And we still live from those two basic assumptions. One is that Christianity provides a kind of social moral glue for civilization, and secondly, such a civilization is superior to others. Those two assumptions aren't totally gone yet. So Aquinas's beautiful vision, as you point out, somehow doesn't get carried over into some practices. Although one must remember, Aquinas got, and it was a heresy at the time, he got his Aristotle from the Arabs. He got it from the Muslims. If you wouldn't have had the transmission of learning by Islam, classic Roman Catholicism would not have been expressed in the way it was. It was the marriage of Aristotle with Augustine.
And much of it into Moorish Spain.
Well, that's the way it came. It came North Africa. And of course, Maimonides, a great Jewish scholar, is a Spaniard influence there. Dale, and then we got to close it down.
If I could add a sacramental celebration to the church, I'd like to call it the first breakfast.
The first breakfast.
Jesus, the catching of the fish.
I see.
Experiencing the bounty.
All 153 of them. Count them. That's how many they Yeah, the first breakfast. Very good.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's go to first lunch.